Hey everybody, it is officially May, which means we have episode stuffs to release. So a couple of quick notes just to let everybody know what's going on with the fundraiser and the blog and all that stuff. If you will check out the blog at this exact moment, you will notice that there's a poll. That poll has to do with a certain perk that is from the Worldcon fundraiser, which will involve me reading something. Specifically, I will be reading Thespeg Zarathustra by Nisha, either as Captain America post-government cutbacks or Yoda. This is a poll that I'm letting you guys pick which one you would want me to do. This is for one of the perks that's in the Worldcon fundraiser, which is the other thing I want to really briefly mention, which is that the Worldcon fundraiser got a huge boost. I'm now like $480 from the full lot. That's all I've got left to go. There are, at this moment, like $34 until the 8th milestone. So there's some more stuff to come. There are a couple more perks that will be coming and all that good stuff. So I do appreciate everyone who's donated so far. If you can spare a little bit, that'd be great. At this point, it's literally just living expenses right now. That's all I've got left to raise. So, and I know there's another donation coming at some point soon, so we'll see what happens. But in any case, if you've got $10 to spare, do feel free to spare it. Otherwise, thank you for listening to the show, and thank you to people who have sent us a message saying they like the show. I really appreciate that. So on that note, I'm going to shut up, and I'm going to let you guys get to the interview with Stephanie Salter.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it was monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 203. I'm Sean.
And I'm Stina.
And we have a special guest today. Our special guest is Stephanie Salter. Hello!
Hello, nice to meet you on Skype. I'm Stephanie Salter. I'm a writer, and I am happy to be with you.
And you're not just a writer. You're a writer who, I believe you've got a second book coming out in the UK.
It's out.
Oh, it's out.
It's out. Yeah, let me expand that. I'm a science fiction writer, at least I'd like to think so, based in London, and my first two books are out, but the wonderful magic of the publishing world means that my first novel, which is just going to be out in the States next week, has already been out in the UK for over a year, and the sequel to that novel has already been out here for a month, but you don't get it for a year. So, you know, if you can work that out, send me a note, would you?
I think we need to have a conversation with your publisher because this is not fair.
Yeah, that's always confused me quite a bit. And then at the same time, I was constantly told that if they didn't have a simultaneous release, then there was no way that anything would ever work out. At least that was what I was told with, like, my first books. So
that's depressing.
I don't know. It's just weird.
It is. But the good news is, I believe because the book is released in the UK first and then the US second, doesn't no, or maybe it's the other way around. I thought the Clark Award, one of the awards, you could be nominated two different years in a row. And I don't know which one it is.
I don't think it is the Clark. I don't think it. I'm pretty sure it's not the Clark. I think Cameron Hurley is an example. Her book's been out in America for a couple of years, but I think it was its first year of eligibility for the Clark because it's just been published in the States. I think the Hugos, you may get a second bite at the cherry if it was published in America a year after first publication in English elsewhere. Although I have to tell you, I am not particularly au fait with the rules around all of the awards. partly because I'm a brand new author and I didn't really expect to be in the running for any of them. So it didn't seem worth the worth the trouble, although nice things have been said about my book, so I possibly should be a little bit more clued up on this.
No, you don't need to. I think half of science fiction and fantasy fans don't understand the rules anyway.
Oh, good. That makes all of us then.
Yeah, yeah. Just this year, nobody knew that you could nominate the entire Wheel of Time for a Hugo until they decided to read the rules and were like, you could interpret this rule to say you can. And, well, now you've seen the ballot. You know what's on there. So, yeah, so I wouldn't worry about it. We'll nominate you for, like, best fan artist and manipulate the rules, and it'll be great. And you'll win for a novel.
I'm not sure that even the most liberal interpretation of the rules would let that one slide through. But thank you for the thought.
You're welcome. So the book we're talking about, because I don't think we've mentioned the title, is Gem Signs. It is out in the U.S. on, I believe it's May 6th.
That's right.
So I think this is going to drop probably on release day. So that'll be great. Everybody should go check it out. But let's start by sort of getting into the nitty-gritty about the book. The basic premise of the book is that at some past point, there was something called the Syndrome, which is tied to, I guess you'd say, network culture. It's infecting humanity, and humanity in desperation decides to basically mess with its genetic code in order to find a solution. And what ends up coming out of this are these individuals known as gems, which are genetically modified human beings who we learn throughout the course of the book presents many issues, not just in terms of civil rights, which is what is, I think, the backdrop for this novel, or maybe not the backdrop, maybe the main issue of the novel, but even more particularly about what genetic testing does to people. And so I wanted to start by actually kind of figuring out what was the impetus for this book. What made you kind of decide to go with this particular route?
You know, one day I'm going to come up with a nice, clean, quick, simple answer to that question. It hasn't happened yet. I had the kernel of the story was a scene that I can't describe because it ended up being the climactic scene of the novel. And if you've read it, you'll know what that scene is. But it was sort of an idea of a conflict, of a really sort of dreadful moment. And then trying to work backwards and work out how those characters had come to be in that place. And I think what happens quite often when you're working through a story, certainly what happens with me, is that it isn't a clear, single idea that you decide to work up. It's all the various things that are in your head that you find interesting or fascinating or problematic or challenging tend to form the little bits of this mosaic that turns it into a story in the end. And one of the things that I do think about are the biosciences, are the medical sciences, are the ways in which the nature of human culture has changed almost unrecognizably just in the last century because of the things that we're now able to do to preserve life, to extend life, to, you know, keep people functional and having reasonably good qualities of life that not that long ago would have been completely impossible. I mean, you know, I'm old enough to remember seeing people who had survived polio when I was a child growing up in Jamaica, which just doesn't happen anymore. So I have this interest in how subtly, almost without people realizing it on a day-to-day basis, the biosciences can completely alter the way we live our lives. And more recently, in the last 20 years, I've seen the way that the information sciences or technologies have done exactly the same thing. And again, almost without us noticing it, you know, the technology that we're doing this interview on right now would have been unthinkable, 10 years ago? And we all use it really automatically now. So I'm giving you a really long-winded answer to your question, but I think the answer to the question is that it wasn't any one thing that made me decide to go down the route of thinking through how modification and how cultural change would alter society. It was all the things that I notice in contemporary culture and think if so much has changed so quickly in my lifetime, and I'm not an old person, how much more quickly could they change in the very near future?
Yeah, that's actually one of the things I found so fascinating about there's a chapter in here, I think it's chapter 5, where you actually sort of present what seems like a kind of news article of the history of the syndrome and the human responses to it. And one of the things that you talk about is how difficult it is for people to change when they realize that the technology that they basically come to, you know, depend upon is possibly the result of is what's killing them, basically, is giving them all these diseases and killing them. And there's, of course, you know, mass panic. There's people who give it up for a little while, but then realize like they can't do anything. And it was interesting because I made a very similar connection to what was the movie we watched? There was a movie we watched in which something very similar to this happened with the, not in terms of the of a disease, but in terms of the technology sort of taking over. And now I've like just had a brain fart. My brain just stopped. Like I got to that moment where I was going to make the connection, and then the movie left my mind. But I found this really fascinating just because it is one of those moments where you realize like what would actually happen if we had to give up our technology, you know, in order to survive. I mean, as you say, like we're talking on Skype right now. I have a smartphone in my pocket. I have in my backpack a tablet computer, which I use for reading. I have a big screen TV next to me, which has network access. I mean, just the things in life that are now daily occurrences, at least for many people, not necessarily all people on the planet. And you also, I love that you address that in the in that same chapter, by the way, that some parts of the world where network access is perhaps not as apparent aren't affected as much. And so
exactly.
I love that moment where you actually explain the difference between the immediate assumption is, oh, it's just the affluent places, like rich people are suffering and the rich get really offended. Because it's like, oh, it's not just us. Like, that's not right. And then, of course, what it is not – it's development, not necessarily wealth, which, of course, development is tied to wealth. But anyways, I like that the network aspect. I like that was the sort of the impetus. And your solution, of course, in the novel is to bring the biotech in. Uh-oh. Who fell out? Oh, that's Dina.
Is she gone?
I hope not.
I don't know. But I'm glad you spotted that and liked it. It's one of those little things you sneak in and, you know, not everyone notices or comments on. But I do think quite often, you know, there's the kind of defaults in fiction of the subject of many, many, many fraught conversations elsewhere, which is that, you know, you talk about writers talk about things that are universal and global, but the culture that you see being affected is it's presumed to be the American or the British or the Northern European, sometimes the Australian culture that the writer is writing from, as though that is a universal experience. And we all know it's not intellectually, but I'm from Jamaica. I'm from one of those developing countries. I really know it's not. And so it was very important to me that if I'm talking about something as a global occurrence, I do not default to the affluent, middle class, well-educated, relatively comfortable defaults of a sort of Anglo-American existence. So that, you know, that was a very conscious decision on my part, I think. And yes, I mean, that section in chapter 5 that you talk about, thinking through explaining the history of the world, was the result of really quite a sustained thought experiment of what would actually happen. And again, one of the defaults that I see a lot, or one of the tropes, I should say, that I see quite a lot in fiction that I never quite believe is what is the notion that you get thrown back to some primitive state if something goes wrong with your technology, that it's somehow given up, that it's somehow one somehow reverts to a previous technological era. And I don't think anything in human history supports that notion. It's not what we do. We find workarounds. You know, we find new ways to keep on doing the things we want to do. And my thinking was, in the event that one technology proved to be so potentially damaging, what we would probably do is use another technology to find a solution instead of throwing all of the toys out of the pram.
Yeah, yeah. So I see you wanted to jump in when I was talking earlier, so why don't you jump in here?
Yeah, I wanted to say that, yes, I really loved that you had made it more of a complete picture on one hand, and at the same time, you also tapped into, have you ever actually read Carrie by Stephen King?
Yes. Unfortunately, I read the book before I saw the film, even though it's a brilliant film, but the book is wonderful, yes.
I mean, which version of the film did you see just off the hand?
The original one. I haven't seen the new one.
Yay! Good for you, because, oh my God. Anyway.
Is the new one going to be a Skiffy and Fanti torture cinema episode? I get that feeling from how you sounded just then.
I don't think so, because I don't think it's terrible.
It's not bad enough.
Yeah, I mean, it does some really interesting things. I think its main problem is we just know the story already.
Yes.
But I feel like, was it Julia Moore, as the crazy religious mother, probably deserved a little bit more love from the Oscar committee, because I don't want her to be my mother ever.
Yeah, she was great, but at the same time, Piper Laurie was just so perfect. It was just, it's so hard to even, but she was great. The one that I had problems with was actually Carrie. But I love the actress, I just didn't buy her as Carrie. But anyway.
Fair enough. Anyway, continue. Yeah.
Enough about Carrie. The book. But I wanted to say, the thing, I don't know if you consciously emulated that particular setup, where Stephen King quotes from newspaper articles throughout Carrie as you go along. And it's just, I think it's a great device, and you did it, you employed it very, very well. You did a great job. And I really liked that.
Oh, thank you. It wasn't actually, can I tell you, I did read Carrie, and it is a wonderful book, but if I'm honest, I'd forgotten that was, I haven't read it in a very long time, and I'd forgotten about that device. No, that was a comment. I've actually written about this in a piece that's going up on IO9 next week, I think, at length, and what I was trying to do with that device. But I had several problems to solve, or perhaps I should say challenges, in trying to work out how to structure the novel. Mm-hmm. And one of them was, how do you fill in the backstory? How do you deal with the info dumping? Which is, you know, it's the bane of every speculative fiction writer's life, because you generally do need to explain how the society you're describing got to where it is. And in this case, it was particularly important because I wanted to paint a portrait of a society facing some really major ethical and legal and economic and social choices. And I wanted to show how it would be possible for that to actually arise in real life. So I had to lay out the sequence of events. But I didn't want to do that, you know, the as you know, Bob, kind of info dumping, where characters tell each other things that you would expect them already to know. But because the source of the problem in the first place was the reliance on network technology, on social, not just on social media, but on that as well as the way that the technology had formed the infrastructure of modern life, I wanted to show that not only had it not been rejected, but that it had become even more ubiquitous as a society had gone on, and it was the way that people relate to each other, and it's absolutely the way that their opinions are formed. And so I sort of had this eureka moment early on when I was trying to work out how to structure the novel, where I realized that if I could drop in and spike it with extracts from that saturated media environment, I could both do the backstory and try hopefully to give the reader a sense of what it would be like to live in this environment where all of these bits of information and opinion are just sort of flying at you from all of these screens that you are never more than 3 feet away from. And that was my solution. So I'm really glad it worked for you, because it felt quite risky when I did it.
Oh no, it worked perfectly. It was great. I really, really liked that. Because again, it just fits so well with what was going on. And I just thought it really worked well. The other thing I liked, it's this concept of pairing up GMOs with people as opposed to GMOs and just plants and other non-human organisms. I really liked that. Because again, I have a thing about, I love clones. I love stories about clones. It's mm-hmm. one of those, and I love stories that are biological science oriented. I studied genetics a little bit in college, and I just find it very, very interesting. And I really liked the take that you had on how the internet itself affects brain, the function of the brain, and how fluid the brain is. I really liked, it wasn't just this panicked, oh my God, the internet does terrible, evil things. Ah! You actually gave some scientific possibilities for why this would affect the brain the way it does. And I liked that.
Good. Well, it is one of the things. I mean, when I said earlier that they're just sort of the random obsessions we all have, one of mine is it's not a panic, but it's a thought, in that I do have a background in a number of things, including genetics. That's what I was going to do until I was actually working in a lab and decided it wasn't the lifestyle I wanted. But it is interesting how much faster we evolve technology and society and culture than we can evolve biologically. And every now and then I just sort of think, you know, I don't know what we should be doing anything differently, but I don't know that we think about the fact that we have altered the environment in which we have evolved to exist immeasurably. So we basically are now living not in the environment that natural selection selected us for, but in an environment we've created. And again, this is a perfect example. We're communicating, not looking at each other through this screen across, you know, about a third of the planet's surface. And that's absolutely fine. It says a lot about how adaptable and plastic and intelligent we are, that we can adapt our communication system, our biological communication system, and understand what's going on, even though we're doing it through the medium of this technology that wasn't around when we were evolving. But I do sometimes wonder what happens, or if it's possible for there to be a disconnect at some point where your environment changes so radically that your biology can't keep up with it. And again, thinking about that, how quickly our communications technology has evolved over the last 20, 30 years, it's probably the most rapid change that has affected the largest number of people in human history. I mean, even other disruptive technologies like the printing press took a long time to filter out to the majority of the population. This one has hit us all in the last 20 years. And you know, and that's not me being alarmist. I think again, the fact that we are managing it so well says a lot for how plastic we are. But it does give you space to start to imagine what might happen if development and evolution, natural selection, fall completely out of sync.
So this actually leads to, you mentioned the consequences of the sort of backdrop to the historical backdrop. And what the major consequence that, and what you deal with specifically in Gem Signs is, you know, after all, like, humanity has now survived the syndrome, we are now at a position where we're not all dying from this mysterious disease, and we can now use our technology without getting horrible things happening to us and death and all that stuff. So now what do we do with all of these genetically modified, well, I say human because I think they're human, but of course that's the question that's being asked, is how human are they, and what rights do we grant them? You know, after all, as Stina had mentioned earlier, right, there is a sort of GMO aspect here, this idea of corporate created beings, and even some of the gemtech companies in this, you know, seem to have a feeling of ownership, or like maybe almost like a paternal ownership over the gems that they have at some point been responsible for. And so that creates this interesting backdrop. The main conflict is your main character, Eli Walker, who is basically tasked with presenting a report which determines how human they are. And I found that really fascinating because, of course, this is a book that's very much about civil rights. It's not about disaster, although that's obviously a part of it. It's about what do we do now when this new leap in technology has taken place? How do we deal with that on a legal level, but also on very much on a social level? And we'll talk a little bit more about those later. Did you always perceive that this was going to be a book that was about civil rights?
Yes. I mean, I didn't sit down in front of a blank computer screen and sort of put that down as a strap line. But it, again, has always been part of the larger question that I wanted to ask, which is how do we understand what it means to be human or what makes us human? There is the sort of the empirical answer to that question in terms of the genetics. There are the social, there are the cultural, there are the organizational aspects to it as well. And the conflicts we have within society, whether they are, you know, based around ethnicities or religions or genders or whatever throughout human history, tend to come from suspicion of difference. And at a very deep level, you kind of, you know, back to evolution, we've kind of evolved to think of the tribe that we are a member of as being the real humans and everybody else as being a little bit different, a little bit weird. And the more different they are from whatever we sort of perceive that default to be, the more suspicious we are of them. It's, you know, not my tribe, get out of my tree, says the monkey brain. And I think at some level, and one of the things I am really interested in is the friction between those very primal aspects of what we are that we are still carrying around with us, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of years later, and these incredibly sophisticated, advanced technologies and civilizational concepts. And they don't always mesh together really well. So I suppose when you distill it all out, you come out with the moniker of it's about civil rights, and yes, it is. But more profoundly for me, and again, I think, you know, my Caribbean background probably feeds into this, although I hadn't thought of it that way at the time. That notion of if people are really different, it's okay to treat them differently, and that is code for treating them badly, is something we've dealt with through history, in every culture, in every part of the world from time immemorial, and we're still doing that. And I wanted to try and construct a scenario that says, okay, what if people are really different? Because we tend to get rid of this by saying, but we're all the same. And then you have the arguments about that. But I thought, okay, is being human really down to the way your genetics are constructed? Is that really what it's all about? Let me construct a scenario in which it's clear that some people have been quite radically altered and could not have been, you know, born in the way that they're presented through any kind of natural process. Is that enough to make them not be human? And if it is, what do you do with them? And if it isn't, then what do you understand being human to be all about? And it was really a way of trying to construct a scenario that let me explore those questions. And civil rights emerges out of that as opposed to being the thing that started it off, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. And it's interesting when you started talking about that, I started making connections to other other issues that are current to our moment, or maybe not like specifically current to our moment, because they may not be things we're talking about. But I mean, for example, you know, the status of in vitro fertilization or surrogate children, or in some cases, a thing in the medical community that's already being talked about is children raised outside of the womb, you know, test tube, the kind of pejorative, the test tube baby, which are very real possibilities of things that could happen. I mean, we could technically, I think it's within realm possibility, we could have full grown test tube children. Or in some cases, as Stina had mentioned before, you know, that she's has this love of clones. And while there are no confirmed cases of human clones in existence, there's no confirmed cases. There are claims that there may be some cloned humans. As soon as we started cloning, that was the immediate question we had to ask was,
of course,
if we do it to people, what does that mean? What are they? Are they still human? And of course, it is kind of an easy answer. Like, my easy answer is, well, of course, they're still human. But of course, that has all kinds of legal ramifications, because we have a legal system that's in place for a particular segment of our species. And how does it now account for a segment of our species that is no longer part of the average or the norm?
And I think that the question, what makes a human, is a vital question, and it's an important one. It's one we should be continually asking.
Bacteria. That's what makes us human. Well, I'm serious. Most of our DNA is bacterial DNA.
Yes, but then they're in everything else. So I'm not sure it's sufficiently distinctive. But no, I think you're right. I mean, it's funny. Again, I've been writing a lot of nonfiction pieces recently, and I've just sent something off, which is talking about the ethics of modification. And I don't know how current this is where you are in the States, but the big story at the moment in the UK, because it's going to probably start happening next year or the year after, is a possibility of children who will have the genetic legacy of not two parents, but three. Do you know about this?
Yes, I heard about this and I got so excited.
It's it's really, really interesting. And of course, you know, the typical headline clamor of three parent babies, triple exclamation marks, with the presumption that this will be a terrible thing. And actually the piece that I just finished writing was around asking, you know, why would that be a reflex reaction? Why would it necessarily be a terrible thing? But I think you are quite right in terms of how the technological development slots into the society that we've developed, because all of our understanding of heritage, of legacy, of what it means to be part of a family and part of a tradition is based on a two-parent family, mother, father, male, female, with a whole inherited set of tropes and rules and mores and traditions around what that means. And we are moving very rapidly away from that being the only way of originating a new human being.
Absolutely. Stina, I saw you had a hand, so you probably want to jump in here.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, when you think about how much historically we've paid attention to who the father is and how much socially we have, how much power we've given to the whole situation about who the father is, not necessarily who the mother is. It's always been very focused on who the father is. If you put in a third factor like that, that's going to shake up things on a very fundamental level. And I think that's that very thing that you're hitting on. And I think that's really fascinating. It's going to be so very interesting.
It's going to be interesting to see where we go. But I think, you know, that was what I was interested in the book, is going, if there are questions of fundamental humanity that transcend those issues of, you know, who your father is, who your mother is, how many mothers have you got, what do you count as a parent, how many yous are there, to go back to your comment about cloning, you know, is there something about humanity that is not that cannot be defined in narrow terms of ancestry or even biology? And if so, what is that?
Yeah, and it is something that you actually deal with here with one of the set of parents. I'm just going to say parents because I'm going to stick with the term, Gayla and Baal, who have adopted a child, which I'm not going to – let's just say the child is important.
Yes.
And not because he's like the chosen one is going to save the world and get superpowers and is Jesus or something.
Yay!
No.
Different important.
It's important because he's a child. And really, you shouldn't need to be the chosen one on top of that. It's just, now that's me being Stephanie the person, not Stephanie the author, going, actually, one of the many tropes that annoys me is the idea that people are only really important if they have a destiny. I have a problem with that. So I do tend to make my characters important, whether they have a destiny or not.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it also brings a sense of realism to the work because, of course, he's not a chosen one. I mean, in many respects, he's a sort of small figure who becomes important through the course of what's happening in the novel and the sort of things that are getting revealed. But it's not because he's got a destiny. It's because of this is the world in which he exists. And in this world, his status is of importance, not because he's somehow going to change things, but because he has a different kind of importance to the scenario. So it is something that's really interesting, and I found it really great that this sort of fascinating element of, you know, these are essentially like surrogate parents who are sort of dealing with this with this new situation. And in this case, I don't think it's ruining anything, but this child can read minds.
Yeah, well, I think that's pretty clear by about chapter 5. So,
yeah.
spoiler up to chapter 5. We'll try not to go any further than that. But he definitely has an unusual ability, let us say. Yes.
Yeah, and we haven't mentioned that all the gems have, or well, most of them are supposed to have some sort of special ability. Like some of them can see in different light frequencies. They can see like infrared and things like that. Others maybe are super strong. They're designed for different purposes. And so they have different kinds of abilities. I'm sorry.
Yes. No, it's the logic of the gems was that if you are in this crisis situation, which they would have been in at the height of the syndrome, and you start making more than just the minimal changes because you need to raise a generation of people very quickly who can do difficult, dangerous work. Once you start going down that road, you know, the nature of exploration is that you keep going a little further and a little further and a little further. And so, yes, every gem has ended up being designed for a purpose. That purpose might mean they get some kind of what we would probably call a superpower, super sight or hearing or strength or speed or endurance. I think, you know, part of the subtext I've tried to build in is that for a lot of it, because they're intended just to be laborers, it's just people who are really strong and can really have incredible stamina, so they can just put up with a lot of stuff. But, you know, there's another character who's introduced early, so I'll mention her, Wenda, and she's created for no reason other than to be the surrogate mother, the womb in which these babies grow. And you know, you think, actually, again, it's a thought experiment, but if you start going down the road where you are creating human beings to be commodities, again, I don't think it's realistic that everybody would always end up with some kind of whiz-bang superpower. You'd be creating commodities to fulfill all of those wet work, drudgery roles as well, if you haven't come up with an external womb, like you were talking about earlier, Sean. And again, you know, they may come up with something like that, but the truth is women's bodies have been designed and evolved to do this job incredibly well. And it's easier and cheaper and much more certain to keep using women's bodies to grow babies and to create some kind of an artificial vessel in which to do that, and the story of that character is about what happens when nobody gets a, you know, kind of some brilliant whiz bang ability to compromise for their state of servitude that's all they are.
Yeah, I will just challenge just a little bit in that I think Wenda kind of has a superpower, which is that somehow she has given birth to 25 children, and I think she's like she's mentioned as being 40 years old, and she somehow survived that.
And I
say that, like, I'm saying being somewhat silly, because, I mean, we recognize, like, I guess technically a woman's body could have 25 kids in her lifetime, but holy good Lord, that is a lot of children.
It's a lot of children. Again, in her case, I think if you're designing someone to do this job, then you would optimize it. But again, across the world, and again across history, in the West, we're used to women having relatively few children. In many parts of the world, it is not, and certainly has not been, uncommon for women to spend a lot of their lives pregnant. Multiple births, twins and triplets, are not particularly common in nature, but they could be if you're implanting embryos, which is what happens in this technology. You can put in as many multiples as you want. I mean, not to stray away from the book into too much of current affairs, but there's been a big news story on this side of the pond recently, where basically it's rehashing the death of a young mother in the Troubles in Ireland 40 years ago, and she was a woman in her early 40s who was a mother of 10. No twins, no multiples, as far as I know, and it wasn't uncommon.
That's so many kids.
So in a way, you kind of posit this in a novel of the future as this amazing thing, but actually, not that far fetched in terms of human history. And again, if you relate it back to something like the history of slavery in the Caribbean and the American South, that was the fate of many women to breed more stock.
And it was very common. My mother is the oldest of nine.
Yeah, I'm the oldest of eight. No twins.
See? Holy cow. It's true. There is a reason we have birth control, people.
Yes to that.
Exactly. There's a reason we have that. There's a reason why it's so important for women to have the right to decide. Mm. So anyway, I'll get off my feminist soapbox.
Your soapbox.
No, that's interesting, because I think, that I mentioned Wenda, and I'm now talking about her more than I planned to. She's very dear to me as a character. But in a strange way, although it's not an overtly feminist agenda in Gem Signs or in Binary, it was one of those ways of saying, once you start to objectify and commodify people, the fact that women's bodies can do a very specific thing very, very well automatically implies that they will be used for that. And then it brings up all of those echoes of the ways in which they have already been used for that without any kind of consent.
Mm. Yeah,
absolutely.
Historical, yeah.
And you're right about it being a superpower for her, because really pregnancy is very dangerous, and people have completely, at least in America, completely forgotten that, that it is a very dangerous thing. And people just figure that, women just have these baby things and it just happens without any stress to the system.
Yeah, we do. I think when you live in a place like, say, the United States, or I imagine maybe even like the United Kingdom, although I can't speak to your mortality rates for pregnancies, but we forget because we have medical technology and we have a lot of research and all these kinds of things that, like, we've created a system in which we can, for the most part, keep women from dying during pregnancy. I mean, it still happens, but it's not common anymore. In other parts of the world, that's not necessarily true, because they don't necessarily have the same access to that information, and so they have higher child mortality rates, or some cases the pregnancies are much more dangerous.
Whereas historically, I mean, that used to be the number one cause of death for women, historically.
Yes.
I climbed on my soapbox again.
Right, okay.
But it's an important distinction to make, so that when we're having a conversation about what is included in your book with Wenda, there is that kind of the historical backdrop that is implied.
Yes, exactly. And it's implied. The historical backdrop is implied, and hopefully, if I've done my job right, the contrast between what her life is like and what the life of a norm woman would be like is also implicit in that, because this is not the situation that any woman would find herself in if she were not a gem and if she were not property of, you know, corporate property in the way that you've already described very well. You know, so this is not simply the lot of women. This is the lot of this commodified system that has allowed an entire subset of people to be treated in this way by the mechanism of defining them as not quite human. And you know, you come back to it again. If you can say that someone isn't really human, then you can justify doing all sorts of things that suddenly become very difficult to justify if you decide that they are.
Yeah, and one of the things that that actually kind of pops to mind is that I mean, just with fruits and vegetables, there are certain genetically, I mean, like tomatoes, for example, a tomato that has been genetically modified tastes very different from a tomato that has the usual traditional methods of, I don't know, I don't even know the term for it.
Organic?
Yeah, well, not organic, but not just organic. There's like I've noticed that I really don't like tomatoes anymore because they taste like nothing to me. And a friend of mine said, you need to check out this particular brand of tomatoes that have not been bred down to nothing. Do you know?
I mean, I get what you're saying, though, yeah.
So I wonder how much of that would actually happen with people as well.
Well, that's, I mean, I think, you know, in real life, who knows? I think in the scenario I set up in the book, and I did do this to sort of up the contrast. I made the non-gem majority population, the norms, relatively homogenous. And my logic for that is that, you know, though they don't like to sort of think of themselves as engineered creatures, they have also had they've been engineered sufficiently at an earlier stage when the crisis was on them to be immune from that particular syndrome and also to be resistant to or immune from most of the sorts of, you know, flaws, errors, diseases, defects that tend to lead to illness and disability. And again, I think this is a fairly plausible scenario. If you've got to the point where you can tinker with the genome sufficiently to make the resulting embryo resistant to a neurological or neuromuscular disease, you would probably take out the things that would make them susceptible to cancers and to other illnesses as well. But the result of it, a century or so on in the world of the book, is a norm population that has lost a lot of that variation in the name of making them healthier and are therefore now much more homogenous. And against that generally more homogenous backdrop, the gems, who are physically very distinct, stand out even more. Now, you know, I mean, I did that as a narrative device. A, it seemed plausible to me in the story, and B, it lets you pop that contrast a lot more strongly. But I think that may speak to your tomato analogy, Stina, because that's about everything becoming so much more the same that it doesn't have much internal distinctiveness anymore.
Right, and it also doesn't have quite enough genetic material to continue to evolve in a healthy way.
I think that's a very good point. It's that if you take out all the stuff that you define as being bad, it may be bad by one set of metrics, but you are also probably making the gene pool shallower and narrower as well. And what are the consequences for that?
Exactly. There are certain things that happen with human beings too. I mean, like, that were actually evolved, that actually evolved in situations like sickle cell anemia, which is terrible, yeah. terrible thing. But it evolved because of, from what I understand, please correct me if I'm wrong, a resistance to malaria or something. I seem to recall that.
It's not, well, it's interesting. It's sickle cell anemia is hugely interesting, and it's natural selection in action. It is a terrible disease. It's very painful. It is very life limiting. It's the kind of thing that in normal circumstances you would not understand why this mutation would have survived in the population, because the people who have it are less likely to live long, happy, healthy lives than people who don't have it, unless they happen to live in an environment where you have malaria-carrying mosquitoes. Because even though they have this dreadful, life-limiting, very painful illness, it means they're less likely to die of malaria. So the healthy people, you know, so the fact that you're in a malaria-ridden environment means that sickle cell is actually an advantage, because it means you're less likely to die of malaria. You'll probably still die of sickle cell, or you'll pass it on to your children. You know, but I think that's actually a very good example of the delicate balance of mutation and of what is, you know, what is a benefit versus what is a negative, really depends on the circumstances you find yourself in.
And honestly, I don't think we as human beings have enough long-term vision to really understand that. So I feel like that is a big question when it comes to genetics and human beings, because we there's like all this business going on with GMOs and corn and all this stuff that I just and the bees, and I just think we. I think this is a great book to bring out those sorts of questions, and I'm really enjoying it for those reasons.
Oh, great. Well, I'm really, really glad. I think, you know, again, it's interesting when I'm discovering this because two books in, I'm still learning how this all works, but it's interesting when you then start to unpack what it is you've done and realize there's stuff in it you hadn't quite known you were putting in it. And that's one of the conversations. I realize one of the things I think is that there is we don't always distinguish as well as we should the difference between the science and the use to which the science is put. And I think, you know, all of the issues around GMO crops and the concerns around them in America over here in the UK and in Europe are really concerns about how the corporations that own the technology will use the technology. And that's kind of overshadowing and guiding the development of the science and the technology itself. But somehow we're focusing on whether we should do the science and not whether how we should regulate the industry, which is a very interesting switch that has been pulled on the public, I would suggest. Because actually the science isn't what's potentially at fault. It's how the industry chooses to or is allowed to use it in terms of proprietary technology and in terms of crowding out other alternatives.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, my parallel, I suppose, is my parallel in the book is not so much the tech, because if they hadn't used it, the species would have gone extinct. It's that if you allow it to be developed under commercial oversight, what are the consequences of that?
Yes.
I really want to. I think this is, again, this is Stephanie stepping out of her author role into her personal role, but of course the two are inseparable. And saying we actually need to disaggregate the science from the social implementations of it, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I feel like this is like the next question because with Frankenstein, right? The main question was, oh my gosh, we're playing God. Should we ever even go this direction? And I think some people are still asking that question, but I think the more significant one is what you're asking there, is the next step. This is the next, it's not, should we, or if we, it's we are there. Sorry, I'm talking too much.
Well, it's less a question of whether or not we should play God, because let's be honest, we're already doing it, and we do it in all kinds of ways, which we don't seem to have a problem with. I think it's fair to say that almost all of us are eating some sort of crop that has been genetically modified in some way.
Yes.
And we're perfectly fine with, I suspect almost all people are perfectly fine with most of them, since most people probably eat apples. And there are no apples that are not, that we eat, that are not genetically modified. As far as I know, because the apple in the olden days was used primarily for alcohol and vinegar because they tasted like crap. The apples we eat today are sweet and delicious, but that's because they have been selectively bred in order to be tasty.
And our carrots are mostly orange, which they never used to be. The carrot breeders of the Netherlands made carrots orange as an homage to the House of Orange, which was the ruling royal family at the time. That's why carrots are orange. Yes, so you're absolutely right. We do tend to forget that we've been doing this for a really long time. It's not the science that scares us, it's the test tubes.
Yeah, I don't know, for me, the part that bothers me is the amount of time. Like you say, it used to happen over a longer period of time, in which case there was more time for us to see the end result. Now it happens within seconds, comparatively speaking, and we don't have time to actually see what ultimately happens, particularly when we, in the United States, don't allow enough space for the whole testing thing to happen in an appropriate way.
I think the lack of time is, but I think also it's not democratized. I think the consequence of having lack of time is that the power is concentrated into particularly small spheres. So it'll be a big agricultural concern. In my fictional world, it'll be the Gemtex. In some areas, it'll be a totalitarian government. When the power to make those decisions are concentrated in a relatively small, relatively elitist, not very transparent and not democratically accountable body, that's when I think you really have to be concerned about the uses to which it is put. Because if we were all able collectively, democratically, to decide that we were okay with GMO crops, then we could make that decision and we would all live with it.
Yeah, and
it's not being part of that process that is problematic.
Exactly.
Yeah, at the same time, I just want to be, we should be careful not to suggest that science, the act of doing science as opposed to applying science, it obviously has to have limitations. An obvious example that many Americans may be familiar with is the Tuskegee experiments, in which they basically just infected an African American community with, I believe it was syphilis, just to see what it would do. And we recognize now that that is disgustingly unethical. And there are obviously psychological experiments of people doing things to babies to see what happens to their brains in the developmental phases, which we recognize now are wrong. That's not to suggest that we shouldn't be criticizing what the science is doing. It's a matter of, in certain instances, it's really not – in the case of GMOs, I don't think it really matters if a scientist is trying to create a carrot that is resistant to a certain kind of beetle and has a natural pesticide that's not toxic to us or whatever. That's not necessarily dangerous if that's not released in the public. But then the question has to be, do we actually release this into farms for farming and for consumption? And if so – what information do we need to know about this product for the general public? And obviously, some of that is going to have to be things like, is it actually healthy for us to eat it? You're modifying something, is it healthy? I mean, we can't just sit there and pretend that you can just do whatever you want to anything, and all of it's just going to be hunky dory.
You just stick in Roundup, and it's going to be fine because people are consuming Roundup.
Exactly.
It's still, in both instances, you're absolutely right, but it does come back to that, the question of transparency. I don't think the even back in the bad old days in which the Tuskegee experiment happened, it wasn't widely known. It wasn't as though people... It is again about concentrating power and knowledge and the ability to make crucial decisions away from the kinds of public scrutiny that will bring an ethical view to bear. And I think that is completely true in terms of medical ethics and always has been, and is equally true in terms of, you know, agricultural developments and so on. And actually, we do a lot better these days in terms of ethical oversight and regulation around things that are understood to be medical advances than we do around things that are thought of as merely, double quotes, merely agricultural or technological advances, even though they affect our lives just as much.
Yeah, absolutely. They do.
In some cases, in a very sneaky way, because, I mean, if you go to the grocery store, you will not find non-GMO'd stuff. I don't know if most of the produce we eat on a regular basis, I don't think any of it is non-GMO'd. At some point.
It's an interesting, because you're in America and I'm in England, so very little that's sold in shops here is GMO because there's been such a huge backlash against it. But it's quite hard to tell. And, you know, as foodstuffs cross international borders and seed stock changes hands and so on, it becomes very, those boundaries become very fluid. And so it's actually a branding exercise to say that something is not this or not that. And it's one of the things I find quite amusing, because I've lived long enough now to see where the kind of brand distinction has gone from saying that something has X, Y, and Z in it to saying that something does not have A, B, or C in it.
Exactly.
It's quite an interesting turnaround that's literally happened in the last 25 years.
Yeah, and in the U.S., the conflict is whether or not we label our foods as GMO'd or non-GMO'd, and if we do label them, what is the definition we use for what we determine what is and is not GMO'd? Because there is some confusion. Like, generally, I think the public thinks that GMO just refers to, like, you know, they spliced a bacteria into it, or they went in and, like, messed with its genetics, as opposed to sort of the old way of doing it, which was just selective breeding.
Yes.
There's obviously a lot of pushback against the labeling. And in the labeling, I mean, in the U.S. in particular, I can't speak to anywhere else, but in the U.S. in particular, labeling is just dumb here. The term organic, I mean, half the time, it doesn't even mean what we think organic means, the public's understanding of organic. Because when we think organic, we mean no pesticides, it's grown, you know, like naturally in the ground, you know, it's not like mass farmed from some sort of like weird place that sprays it with stuff, you know, like it's organic, like aside from the fact that it's made on a farm, it would be like if you went into the woods and you found it, right? That's not what organic actually means in the United States in the legalized term. So what they can call organic doesn't actually have to be 100% organic. It can be only partially organic, which seems completely mad to me, but okie dokie.
Yeah, I agree.
And there are all kinds of weird rules like that where it's like, well, if it says it is X, it only needs to be 51% of that. Otherwise, it's so, like, for example, meat patties at fast food restaurants, they can call it beef if it's a certain percentage of beef, even if the rest of it's not beef. The rest of it could be like donkey toes or something. And doesn't matter, because as long as that like majority percent, it's like 50 something percent is beef, then you can call it beef. But
it comes back to the whole question of definition.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Of what set, you know, whether you're talking about the constituents of quote unquote beef patties or the constituents of a human culture. What goes in? What are the understood and shared assumptions that go into defining those terms? And do we all use the same words, but do we all mean the same things by them? And I think there's a lot of very natural misunderstanding that happens. But one of the things I'm interested in is the way in which that can be manipulated in these kinds of debates. So, you know, if you are aware of the way in which certain kinds of language, certain kinds of suggestions, certain kinds of terminologies work on people's understandings of the underlying thing, then that's actually a huge industry in terms of branding, in terms of spin, in terms of marketing, in terms of just how you influence public opinion to try and get the outcome that you're trying to get. I mean, you know, we're used to this in terms of business. We're used to this in terms of politics. It's one of the things that is also in the book because it's one of the things I'm interested in.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that, and going back to the whole Frankenstein thing, is like during that era, it was like science and ethics were being very much emphasized, and that used to be like a thing. But now we have science plus business, and business has pretty much kicked out ethics on a certain level. And so that, I think, it's an important thing to notice and take note of and think about. Mm. But I don't know if it's as much true outside the U.S. as it is within the U.S. I mean, business is everything here. Profit is king.
In other places, it's, well, again, this is one of these areas where the balance shifts depending on where you are in the world and what time period you're working through. I think in the States, where I lived for many years, there is definitely a very, very strong corporate and commercial lobbying. And there's something about American culture prioritizes that and doesn't view it with quite as much suspicion as, say, here in the UK, which is also a very, very business-friendly environment, but which has a much stronger sense of social justice and the welfare state is not a dirty term here, and therefore it makes it possible to hold some of those commercial and corporate concerns to account, because it's not considered an automatically suspicious or non-British act to do so. But I think what that says about culture, which is really interesting, is that it is not any one static thing. And everybody tends to think that the world works the way it works for them. But what that is completely variable depending on where you are and what time you're living in. And again, how those barriers get negotiated is one of the things I'm very interested in.
So I do need to issue a correction because I was wrong about a detail, and I don't want to leave that on the show without correcting it. McDonald's, as far as I can find, the myth that McDonald's beef is not from real beef, or at least some of it is not real beef, seems to be a myth, according to Snopes. So I'm going to assume that the thing that I read is bullshit and that I should probably discard it, which is why it is always good to do research on any claim that you read. So as far as McDonald's is concerned, it is 100% beef. It only comes from USDA grade Q beef, or whatever grade beef it is. It's certainly not high quality beef. It may be pink slime. I don't know, because there's a thing about pink slime, and I think McDonald's stopped using it recently. But in any case, I just wanted to issue a question because I didn't want to leave that there.
But I think actually the fact that you've just found it all there, these two competing narratives, speaks to the point about competing narratives. You know, I think that's just indicated exactly how true that is. You've got the kind of competing polemics right there, don't you?
Yeah.
Who would like you to think that it is something that it's not?
I will just say that 70% of ground beef sold in the U.S. contains pink slime. I don't know how much of the percent of that 70% is pink slime, but since that's a related component. But in any case, the thing that I actually wanted to shift basically is going to be the last major question, because we've been talking very much about all the science and sort of the implications that has on a social culture. But one of the aspects we haven't really touched on in your book is you actually address a religion here, which is very interesting because anyone who knows anything about Europe, it has a very different relationship to religion than the United States does in terms of its religiosity. So it was very interesting to see a book that is set there and is sort of dealing very explicitly with this. And just to talk about the two major sides here, one side is what are known as the God gangs, who are part of a kind of, I guess you'd say, a sort of extremist, I guess almost like an extreme nationalist group, but instead of dealing against immigrants, they're dealing explicitly against GEMs, and they commit a number of acts of violence and those kinds of things. And the other group is actually a more friendly group, which has aligned itself with the GEMs in support. The GEMs, of course, assume that this is so they can get congregation numbers, which may be true, or maybe they actually believe it. And I was really interested in this aspect because though it's not as central to the book as some of the other larger questions, it is something that I noticed jump out at me. Mm-hmm. And I was curious what made you want to address the religious aspect in this way? I mean, what was sort of the impetus?
Well, in purely crass novelistic, you need to have a conflict term. You know, there was you need to create some kind of a threat. So I was thinking about religion anyway. I knew that that was always going to be one of the aspects of the book, creating the very reactionary, violent God gangs. It does something, enables some of the structural aspects of the novel to proceed. It's the kind of thing I should probably talk about in a writing workshop. But I think religion is very interesting. It is one of those very fundamental cultural constructs that we've inherited. So like everything else, it plays hugely into that fundamental question of how do we decide who is or is not a human? You know, historically, what people believe, what they base their understanding of right and wrong, their sort of moral grounding on, has come out of religion and has been quite fundamental to how cultures have understood themselves and understood cultures that are different to their own. So I thought it was important in this scenario to not ignore that tendency for belief to override logic or to form its own kind of logic. But I also thought it was important to look at religion as fairly as possible, and to acknowledge that in addition to the ways in which it can persuade people to exclude others, even to the point of violence, because they are somehow not of the chosen, which would represent the God gang view, the flip side of that is the charitable side of religion that is actually about inclusion and support and accepting a sort of sense of universal humanity. And I do think this is, I'm not a religious person, but I do think this is one of the really interesting aspects of religion, is that somehow within this entire social construct, it manages to embrace these completely oppositional sides of human behavior and human personality. You know, the best of us and the worst of us claim religion as a reason for being the way they are. So I think that is actually quite important. But I think in terms of the God gangs specifically, for those who have a really strong antipathy towards the GEMs, towards the way the world has changed, whose ultimate wish is for something safer and simpler and more understandable, and in which they are quite unquestionably the top of the tree, religion gives those sorts of people with that sort of mindset a framework in which they can justify acting on the impulses that they had anyway, and they can create a sort of a logic under which to, you know, on which to underpin that sense of superiority and that sense of being the true humans. Mm-hmm. If, you know, I'm not sure how well that's answering your question, but that was part of what I wanted to do, was use that innate human desire for belief and try to see how that would play out in this scenario. And you're absolutely right. I have played it out at the two extreme ends, and there's very little in the middle. But that's what happens when you need to put narrative tension into a book.
I think it's okay to do that, because this isn't a book about religion. It's a book about something else in which religion becomes a part. If it was a book about religion and you only presented the two sides, I would say that's lazy. But in this case, it makes sense that you would not try to address every single different type of religious response, because, well, it's not a book about religions. It's a book about, civil rights and, a changing culture, which is a much more broader concern than just a religious concern. But
yes, and religion is an aspect of culture. So I think you've actually explained it better than I did, because it's about changing culture and it's about religion as an element of culture. But it's equally about family, which is an element of culture. And you know, you mentioned Gala and Bal and their adopted child earlier. So that was how I wanted to pull that aspect in, and how newcomers are incorporated or rejected into a culture. And so it was really about me trying to pull all of these different strands of what culture is and examine them in this environment in which things are changing so rapidly.
Yeah. It's very interesting. I mean, just the amount of elements that you sort of incorporate into this. For one book, I mean, there's a lot of different aspects: the science, the family aspect, the religious aspect, the legal framework. I mean, you even have a chapter in here which lays out a new United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, which I thought was really, really great that this sort of pops out of nowhere. But it's a perfect document, because, of course, there is a Declaration of Human Rights that currently exists in the UN. And well, that's going to have to change as what constitutes as human alters, as it does in your proposed possible future, alternate future. Who knows? But maybe this is going to happen. I hope not. Please no. Oh my God, my cat just was crazy. Sorry, that was a loud noise. But in any case, so it is a very interesting take on all of those aspects, including the religious aspects. I liked that was there, and I think partly because I think it had to be there to some extent. Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah. So on that note, we gotta wind down, because otherwise we'll just keep you here for 16 more hours, and you've got a life.
Well, it's also the time difference. So, I lost my train of thought there for a moment. It is quite easy to get wrapped up into having very detailed discussions about these things. And of course, one of the things that happens to writers, certainly one of the things that happens to me, is that the more I am asked to talk about it, the more I think about it, the more I notice things, which I probably always knew because I put them in the book, but I hadn't been consciously aware of them at the time, the more that sparks an idea for the next thing I'm going to be working on. And so there's a point at which you're torn between continuing the conversation and running away into the corner to scribble down the thoughts that the conversation have just triggered. And I think I've just come to the conclusion that is part of what it is to be a writer. You're always kind of torn between experiencing and then wanting to express what you're experiencing.
Yep.
Well, you're welcome. So, okay. So real quick. I know that the book is already out over there. So this book, Gem Signs, hits shelves on the 6th. So it may or may not be the 6th when this drops. So if it's the 6th, then you have to buy the book. But what can folks expect from you, actually anywhere, because we have somewhat of an international audience, so in, say, the next 6 months or so?
Well, I'm actually going to be spending most of the next 6 months not talking to anyone and writing the third book. The second book, Binary, is already out in the UK and most of the Commonwealth countries. So it's quite interesting. America's talking about a book that I finished several years ago and published a year ago. Britain is talking about the second book in the series. And I'm trying to find time to write the third. So the second book, Binary, as I said, has been out for about a month, in fact, exactly a month, in Britain. And it obviously picks up and continues the story. It should drop early next year in America. So essentially everything is sort of about a year offset. I am going to be spending most of the rest of this year writing the third and I think final book of the Evolution trilogy, which is going to be called Gilong. But I am going to be taking a little bit of a time out from that in May, in this month, in 3 weeks. Goodness, we are in May. I'm going to be in Jamaica seeing my family, but also at the Calabash Literary Festival, where I'm going to be reading along with Karen Lord, who I think is also a friend of the podcast, and an array of other wonderful, wonderful writers. And in August, I'm going to be first at the Nine Worlds Convention here in London, the London Geek Fest, where I'm going to be on various panels and I'm going to be giving a writing workshop. And then barely a week later, I'm going to be at the World Science Fiction Convention, LonCon.
Yeah.
And yay. I think I'm going to be on program there too, although I don't have any details to share with you. And then I'm going to go back into my hole and finish writing Gillow.
Excellent, excellent. And where can folks find you on the interwebs?
They can find me on the interwebs. My website is stephaniesalter.com. And I have links to all of my books, reviews, various mutterings and murmurings and stuff. I'm one of those bloggers who goes in fits and starts. So I'll sort of post a lot of stuff very rapidly, and then I will disappear for 2 months. But when I disappear, it's usually because I'm writing something much more interesting that I can't share. But I do keep that pretty current with what's going on. So that's stephaniesalter.com. And I am on Twitter as Scriptopus, is my Twitter handle. I'm fairly present there. I'm a bit more reliable on Twitter. And I've got a Facebook page, which is also Stephanie Salter Writer.
Excellent, excellent. Well, on that note, everybody should go check out Gem Signs. It'll be out, and it's cool, and you should definitely read it. It's a really good book, and I recommend it. And
me too.
If you are in the UK, you have to get Binary, because you already get it, and then you should basically just ship a copy to the United States, because I'm not going to wait a year.
You're going to be here, aren't you? You're possibly, hopefully, fingers and toes crossed, coming to LonCon, aren't you?
Oh, no, I already booked my flight, so I will be there.
Fantastic. Okay, right.
Yeah.
So we know you'll be getting a copy.
Oh, well, yes, I will. That's right. Yeah. People on the other side of the world should definitely check out Binary. If you've not already read Gem Signs, then you can get both, which is cool. And then you can read them back to back and you can have a good life. And so, in any case, so thank you, Stephanie, very much for coming on and talking to us about your book.
Yes,
thank you very much for having me on. It's been a great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Sina, for being my co-host.
No problem. This is my favorite subject. I love this. Anyway.
All right. And on that note, awkward ending and scene. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
you're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.
Hey everybody, welcome to the World SF Tour, our special feature throughout the year in which we're obviously celebrating World SF. There are a number of ways you could support this show, just really quick. One is you could subscribe to the show. We're on iTunes, we have the blog, all that good stuff. There's all kinds of cool stuff on the blog too you should check out. That's one way you could support us. You can obviously let people know about us. That's really cool when people do that, link to us and all that good stuff. And the other way is actually to go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1 month free trial membership. You get a free audiobook out of the deal. You get to try their service if you like it, to keep it, which is cool. And yeah, I mean, that's really that simple. So that helps us as much as the rest of it does. But in any case, thank you for listening. I really hope you enjoy this year, this very specially themed year. And of course, if we missed anything, which we're undoubtedly going to do, feel free to let us know. Send us an email or leave a comment or something. Maybe even on some of our discussion episodes, you let us know about some great works from a certain region that we should be talking about. So in any case, I'll let you get to the episode, and I hope you enjoy it.